And with that said, we've got a very special guest on the line right now. I am joined by Bruce Castor, who was lead attorney for Mr. Trump during his second impeachment hearing. Mr. Castor was also a former district attorney for Montgomery County and a county commissioner there, as well as solicitor general and acting attorney general for the state of Pennsylvania. Bruce, good morning. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, good morning. Thank you for having me on the program.
All right, so let's start off with your overall assessment of the trial. Were you surprised by the verdict?
Not at all, no. I'm seeing the effects of the outrageous bias against President Trump whenever I'm handling cases around the country. I see it in D.C. when I do 1-6 cases. I saw it in New York when we had another case for the Trump Organization, a criminal case, against that same DA's office in that exact same courthouse. In that case, of all the 200 jurors that were summoned, 95% or more said they had a fixed opinion against President Trump, could not set it aside no matter what the judge said. And 10 out of 12 of the jurors chosen maintained that. So the bias is so great in these jurisdictions. I see it in Atlanta. I see it in New Jersey when I have cases there. That I was not surprised in the slightest.
What did you think of the way that Judge Merchan handled the trial and specifically his instructions to the jury?
Well, I've been in the court system for 40 years, actually 42 years, and I've never seen anything like that. I mean, he didn't just put his thumb on the scale, he put his entire fist on the scale. The jury instructions, they sound to me like you see on television programs when they're showing a British judge instructing the jury in such a way as to guarantee a certain outcome, which in Britain is the judge is allowed to become much more involved. But that's not the way the United States judicial system is supposed to work. And the notion that that the judge would sort of telegraph to the jury how he wanted the case to turn out is outrageous. I mean, I thought his conduct throughout the trial was outrageous and totally at odds with what I'm used to seeing in courtrooms around the country.
How about the way that Donald Trump's attorneys performed? How would you assess that?
I was watching them, and I always try to think, would I have done anything different or could I have done anything better? And I actually didn't think I could. I mean, I thought that they did as well as they could under very trying circumstances. We were in that exact same position when we represented the Trump Organization in the fall of 2022, where the organization was the defendant and not the president, but it was the same sort of atmosphere. And you do the best you can, and you hope everyone else does their job the way they're supposed to, but when they don't, there isn't anything you can do about it.
As an attorney, what do you make of the two requests the jury made of the judge during their deliberations?
I got the impression that there was a minority of the jurors that did not understand the communications from the judge and did not remember some of the testimony the same way and wanted that repeated. When the end of the day comes and it's go home and come back tomorrow, or you can end all this by just raising your hand for guilty, those few holdouts did that.
Now, as far as the trial itself is concerned, I found it interesting that the federal government refused to try Trump, basically saying they had no case. Yet Alvin Bragg, the district attorney from Manhattan, not only brought the case to trial, but got a guilty verdict on all charges. What's your take on that?
Well, my take on it is that the lawyers, the professional lawyers, the ones that are there regardless of who the president is in the Justice Department, made a legal determination and made the correct legal determination. But you see, the senior members of the Justice Department who are not political appointees, they don't have to answer to the electorate. And Alvin Bragg has to answer to his electorate. And he promised that he was going to go, quote, get Trump when he was running for office. So there's no downside to Alvin Bragg proceeding against Trump because he knows that the local media, and to some extent the national media, and all of his voters are cheering him on, and that if he doesn't prevail, then so what? And there's not going to be any – nothing bad happens to him for what he did, because he knows that the governing authorities of lawyers in New York aren't going to do anything about him, and that if he swings and misses, he's still got the electorate and the media behind him because he tried. But he also knows that the jury is heavily stacked in his favor, so there's no downside to him because he does not have to follow his oath to uphold the Constitution. He instead follows his desire to maintain his power base and the support of the electorate. Well, members of the Department of Justice who are appointed lawyers who got there because of their ability to analyze the law and apply them to a given fact pattern don't have any electorate to play up to.
I'm speaking with Attorney Bruce Castor, who was lead attorney for Donald Trump during his second impeachment hearing. Bruce, as far as the appeal is concerned, and I'm sure that the Donald Trump's lawyers are going to appeal this. If it was you, what issues in this case would you be filing an appeal on?
You know, that's an interesting tactical problem for the lawyers. I don't know whether I'll be consulted on it or not, but so far I haven't, so I feel free to talk about it. There are so many mistakes and reversible error in this case that you have to pick and choose which are the best ones. Otherwise, the appellate court thinks you're using a shotgun approach, and you create the initial impression to the Court of Appeals that that you are complaining too much. Because no trial could possibly be this bad. And we see those are decisions that lawyers taking appeals have to make all the time. But, I mean, certainly the lack of the requirement of unanimity on what the underlying bad acts were is right up there. The suggestion that the district attorney has jurisdiction to prosecute federal election law crimes is high up there. The notion that the judge gave instructions that were far outside the standard jury instructions. I mean, maybe the listeners might not know, but in a criminal trial, and really in any trial, there is a list of standard instructions for all sorts of cases that the Supreme Court of that jurisdiction has written out as the suggested instructions for trial judges to use, because those are the ones that have been proven to be reliable over the years. Well, this judge has radically departed from those model jury instructions. I would pick apart every one of those that deviated from, I guess it's the Court of Appeals in New York, that was instruction used. Those are the sort of things that they would be appealing. There's the sideshow of the gag order that everybody involved in the case from the prosecution side could say anything they wanted, but President Trump couldn't say anything for fear of being attacked. Well, the whole idea of a gag order is not to pollute with evidence that is not provided in the courtroom. But everybody already has an opinion about Donald Trump. So what he's doing is he's trying to counterbalance the negative attacks on him. Extrajudicial statements. But
Bruce, I keep losing you on your cell phone. Bruce, are you still there?
Yes.
Yeah, I keep losing you every once in a while because we've got a bad cell phone connection there. Let me ask you this. I got from at least one media source that there were possibly two lawyers who were on that jury. Did you hear that? And if that's the case, What's your thought? If you were the defense attorney in this case, would that be to your favor or not to have attorneys sitting on that jury?
I ordinarily did not like having attorneys on my juries because I always thought that the attorneys would think they were smarter than me. So my guess is that they would not like that. But the jury pool is so heavily contrary to any sort of fair jury of his peers that these lawyers, they have to grab hold of something, and they may have thought that that lawyers on the jury might listen to the law. So it's hard for me to put myself in their shoes, given the horrific jury pool they had to draw from.
I personally am rather surprised that the deliberations went another day. I thought for sure that it would be a quick verdict that would come down sometime late on Wednesday, as opposed to heading into Thursday. What were your thoughts on that?
I thought if it was a quick verdict, it would be an acquittal, because from a legal perspective, there wasn't enough evidence that the case should have even been brought, much less given to the jury. So if the jurors were able to sort through the nonsense that came from the judge and apply the facts to the law, they would quickly determine that this was a ridiculous prosecution brought for political motivation. So as it dragged on, I became more and more convinced that it would be a conviction, and I had predicted on multiple occasions in public that I thought the jury would make it so that he would be convicted. So it actually did not surprise me that it went beyond the first day.
In your opinion, given the fact that this trial was held in New York and all of the jurors were New Yorkers, and you're talking about a very blue state, do you think that played a role in the outcome of this trial? And would it have been the same if it was held in some other state?
It absolutely played a role. That's the whole reason why Alvin Bragg felt comfortable bringing the charge, because he already knew the deck was stacked in his favor, because in that narrow jurisdiction, the percentage of anti-Trump people is enormous. The larger you get say, even in New York State, the further you get out away from Manhattan, the more conservative the people are. So if you had taken that same trial and plopped it down, you know, in the western part of New York or the northern part of New York, you would have had a far different jury panel. This jury panel was as though they were already infected from the massive coverage, to the point where ordinarily we would ask for a change of venue or a change of veneer, because you have, you know, a high profile murder and all the people in the community know about it. Well, here you have a high profile defendant and a high profile case that everybody in the jurisdiction knew about it. And it's the kind of case that would have warranted moving it to another county, in New York, to try to get a better cross section of jurors.
I'm talking with attorney Bruce Castor, who, among other things, was lead attorney for Mr. Trump during his second impeachment hearing. Bruce, share with me, what are your thoughts of the judge's decision not to sequester the jury over the Memorial Day weekend? Was that a mistake or not?
It's a mistake from the point of view that the judge should have made some effort to make sure that the jurors were not subject to media accounts. He probably should have sequestered them the whole trial. And then in the many big cases that I handled, the jurors were always sequestered. So sequestering them over the Memorial Day weekend would have been prudent, but he probably should have sequestered them the whole time. Though I don't think it would have made any difference, because I think all of the jurors who were seated in the case already knew they were going to do whatever they could to get Trump, just like Alvin Bragg said he would, from the day they were sworn in.
All right, so share with us what is next here for Donald Trump In addition to the appeal process, we're looking at 158 days now before November 5th, the general election day. What's next for Donald Trump with this case?
Well, in the ordinary procedure, the next step is he has to be sentenced. His conviction is not finalized until he is sentenced, and I understand it's scheduled for July 11th. I don't know whether that date will actually happen or not, but then the appeals process within New York would commence, and I can say with a great deal of assurance that as he moves up the appeal ladder in New York, he will get better and more unbiased judges. And we all you have to do is look at Harvey Weinstein's convictions being reversed to see, you know, the further up you go, eventually you get people who actually pay attention to the law and are not trying to hurt somebody because they're bad in their judgment. That's the ordinary procedure. My guess is that the team representing President Trump on appeal will try to appeal to a federal court to assume some jurisdiction because of the effect on the national election. I think that's a long road to hoe because that clashes with concepts of federalism and dual sovereignty, where we're supposed to give states some measure of deference before the appellate court or the federal court becomes involved. Now, if the judge were to try to imprison Mr. Trump, I think you would see a flurry of activity in the federal court, and I think the federal court would take jurisdiction and quickly, at the very least, order him released pending the appeals so as not to disrupt the election.
Now, the judge, Mershon, does have some latitude here in what he can impose as far as the sentence is concerned. It doesn't necessarily mean that he'll order a prison time for Trump. Is that right?
Well, yes. I mean, that's certainly the case. And in fact, if you look at the history of sentencing in that county, Mr. Trump would, if he was anyone else, it would be almost a guarantee that he would receive probation. But you just don't know with the heavy bias against him what will happen. I think from a strategic standpoint, it would be insane for the Democrats and the left to push for a jail term, because I believe what happened yesterday almost assures that President Trump wins the election, and putting him in jail would even make that more the case, because outside the echo chambers that these people operate in, whether it be D.C. or New York City or Atlanta, the rest of the country is looking at this in horror. Like, what are you doing? This is ridiculous. And you're fiddling with our choice of who we want to be president. And, you know, the 20% of people in the middle that haven't made up their mind are wondering, how on earth is this happening? And those people are going to break for Trump, I think.
Bruce, we're almost out of time. Any final thoughts?
I think about our appearance on the world stage. I've done some BBC broadcasts, both for their international and their national services. And you know, the questions that I get lead me to wonder what the international community thinks of the circus that the United States has become. And I thought that our judicial system was a model for the world to follow, and I was a product of that system. And now I'm beginning to wonder if we've turned it into a joke, and what does the rest of the world think about us?
Bruce Castor, attorney Bruce Castor, with me this morning. Bruce, thank you for the last-minute invite to come on the show today. I'm so glad that you were able to find time to be with us today, and it was a pleasure talking with you this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. It was fun.
All right. Bruce, take care. Bruce Castor, who was lead attorney for Mr. Trump during his second impeachment hearing, with me this morning. And we'll be back with more feedback in just a bit. Stay with us.